Welcome to the 2017 Advisory Committee on Physician Credentialing Information. And I'll just take a second to introduce myself. I think this is my first meeting. I'm not sure I've met everyone. I'm Valerie Chris. I come from Providence Health and Services, and I've been on this committee for many years with our past chair, who's done a wonderful job. So I just wanted to say hi. So we can officially call this meeting to order.
Thank you.
Thank you. So thank you, everyone, for joining, members, staff, and public guests. If there are any public guests in attendance right now, please take a minute to sign in.
Right, you can sign in on the webinar. There's no public guests in the room, so if there were, we would have them sign in on our sheet. We generally don't have much public attendance at this meeting.
Good.
It's a public meeting.
Yes. And if they were on the phone, they would have already signed in. Yes.
Right, okay. Right. And we'll open the phone lines in the last 15 minutes for public comment.
Okay, great. So maybe we can do a, we already said who was in the room, but we can do a quick round robin just for people to introduce themselves again officially to start the meeting. Can we start with you, Cindy?
Sure. I'm Cindy Madden from Baker Allergy, Asthma, and Dermatology.
Thank you. I'm Dorothy O'Keefe from Family Care Health. Sarah Wickenhagen from the Board of Nursing. I'm a family nurse practitioner, and I use the credentialing packet.
Hey, you'd be representing practitioner organizations.
Recently filled it out.
Okay. Great, thank you. And then on the phone?
Kane Lau, I am the credentialing manager for Kaiser Permanente.
Thank you.
This is Eric Novak, St. Charles Health System payer credentialing manager.
Thank you.
Mark Bonanno, Oregon Medical Association.
Great, thank you very much. And Melissa Isaboran from OHA is here, and she would like to introduce the OHA staff.
Hi. Well, I'm the program manager for the Common Credentialing effort. This group rolls underneath that, because we'll be using the Common Credentialing form, which is the OPCA, for our system that we will be using to centralize and collect and verify information on credentialing. So I'll give you a little bit of an update on that in a minute. And Luke?
And I'm Luke Lowoski, also with OHA. I'm an analyst on the Common Credentialing Program, working alongside Melissa and helping staff this group as well.
Okay, thank you. So the next order of business is to approve the minutes from our 2016 meeting. They were included in the packet. It's the second document. And we'll give a few minutes for everyone to take a look at it. And we're wondering if there are any changes needed.
Yeah. Quite a few of you were not here for the last meeting, and it has been a year. But,
yes. I took a look at the minutes, and I don't remember having anything.
Okay. Do you, anybody want to make a motion to approve the minutes?
Do you need another minute? Or
that
you can if you want.
They weren't there.
Yeah.
So, if you can go ahead, Mallory, and I don't know if you have anybody
I'd like to make the motion to accept the October 26, 2016 ACPCI minutes. May I have a second? And would that be Mark that to make it?
Yeah, Mark.
Yeah, Mark was probably on the line last time. Mark, you want to give a second? A minute approval?
Second.
Thank you.
Yeah.
This is more of a formal committee, so we're doing motions and everything else here. So.
And those in favor, please indicate so.
Aye.
And anyone opposed?
Aye.
Who said that? Who said opposed? I think that was an aye to approve, right?
Thank you. If there are any members who wish to abstain from voting, you can let me know. But I think I heard everyone say aye.
Yeah,
right. Okay, the 2016 ACPCI minutes have been approved. The next thing we wanted to do was look at the membership update. So included in the packet was the ACPCI membership roster. We have a number of new members, as you know, and two members whose terms expire at the end of the year. Luke is going to walk us through the process for maintaining our full committee membership.
Yeah, so we've gone through our introductions, so we're glad to have our new members on the committee, and welcome. The two members with expiring terms at the end of this year are Leah Assay from Trillium, and Leah actually retired this year, so she will not be seeking renewal of her term, so that spot as a payer representative on the group will be open. And then Mark, you are the other member who is expiring this year, and we would be very happy to keep you on if you're willing to renew your membership.
Glad to.
Thank
Great.
You.
That's good to hear. And so the process that we'll do for filling the health plan Leah's spot is we'll ask members right now if you have any recommendations. You don't have to speak up now. Feel free to email me with anything you have. We'll also ask Leah if she wants to nominate somebody as her replacement. If we can't get a nomination going that route, we may go to our Common Credentialing Advisory Group, which is our other public group that our advisory group on the Common Credentialing Program for recommendations that should work. Worst comes to worst, we will do a formal public solicitation to fill that spot. And that's all I had on membership.
Any recommendations for a health plan representative? Did someone else just join?
It's Danielle from Twality.
Yay, thank you. We have all our members here, Danielle, except for Leah Assay, who has retired. So we were just asking if anyone had a health plan representative nomination. Okay, hearing nothing, then we'll proceed with asking our other stakeholders if they have a nomination or have interest.
Great. Thank you, Liz.
Yep.
The next item on our agenda is the Common Credentialing update, and as Melissa mentioned, she's going to provide us with that update, and we have materials in our packets as well.
Right. So I'll just go over the background quickly. Most of you are very familiar with this. I've talked to many of you several times and in several different forums or circumstances. But essentially, we have a legislative mandate at OHA to carry out a centralized system to house verified credentialing information. And the background really is practitioners really wanted to see some efficiencies, consistencies, and coming together centralization of the collection of this information because of the burdens it produces when they're having to do it individually for different credentialing organizations, but they're all really collecting the same stuff. So everyone is basically in general agreement that, yes, we could come together, centralize this. The trouble is in how we do it. So it's really hard to centralize a process that's already in existence in many different ways, facets, whether it's efficient or not efficient. And so it's been a very interesting process. It's been a long one. We've had this common credentialing forum since pretty much the year 2000. So going on 18 years. So quite a few years we've had that. So this that was actually a call to do something about centralizing collection. It's great that we have the form. We want to use it, as I said, as a template for the system that we are creating. It's a very well thought out form. Our old chair used to say it's a well oiled machine form. We get together, we've thought this out. We have our health plan representatives on this group that manages the form, and the hospitals and also the provider organizations. So we have a very thoughtful form for the state of Oregon, which is fantastic. But that said, we just had that form, and we didn't have any kind of centralized system. So there were multiple systems. You're mailing it out to multiple organizations, trying to make sure you're updating your information to multiple organizations. So if you're credentialed with 10 different organizations. I've heard even 40 different organizations from the sponsor of the original legislation back in 2013. You may send it out to 5 different folks. And I said, did I send it to that health plan? Do I need to send that again? And which ones do I still have on my list? I'm checking out, licking envelopes. I don't know. So in any event, this is just something that has been called for. And I know that the Oregon Health Leadership Council spent quite a lot of time on trying to create this, looking at the Washington solution, but wanting to expand it to do primary source verification and getting collective buy-in. And what they kept struggling with is if not all practitioners were in, it isn't useful for the organizations and vice versa. So they were still kind of working on that effort when this legislation came into play. So OHA was pretty much tapped as a neutral entity to carry this out, and so that's what we're doing. We've come a long way. We've been working with about 50 stakeholders regularly through our subject matter expert group, being 30 members strong, and our Common Credentialing Advisory Group, which is another public meeting, public group, where we have about 20 different members on that group, serving the same types of organizations, but also including ambulatory surgical centers and IPAs. So I venture to guess you guys understand the value of having a centralized system. If we can create it in the most perfect way, yay, but we know there's challenges with that. So I'll kind of walk through that a little bit. The next slide is essentially the components of the program, and the one thing, next slide. And the one thing I wanted to point out here is obviously a centralized system. There's a couple things I want to point out here. We have the 120-day attestation requirement, and that's to ensure that we have information up to date by the time folks need it to grab it and take it to committee and have it be within an appropriate time frame for an approval of a credentialing decision. That has been a contentious piece of this program because a practitioner having that ownership of their data and the liability attached to that data is on them. So they will actually have to sign in, username and password, and physically push the attest button. Otherwise, their designee can manage everything else and all of the other information. But just that act alone has been kind of a concern on the practitioner's part, in the sense that right now they're just slipped a form and having to put that wet signature on it. It's a little bit different when you're like, oh, I have to have a username and password, and I got to be in front of a computer. So we're kind of working through that with practitioners. Again, it was really a call from practitioners, and we're wanting this to help them, not burden them more. So I wanted to make that point to you guys. Credentialing organizations retrieving the information, this is going to very much interrupt their workflows. We understand that. There are some organizations that will have a little bit more difficulty than others. For organizations that have a good centralized, efficient process, this is really going to take them back a little bit to be able to go to another system and get that information and put it into their current system if they're using it across locations or housing other information in their current systems. They're not going to be able to just use ours. So most of you will end up keeping your same systems. Then healthcare regulatory boards, we are trying to leverage their information. Practitioners already put a lot of information to their licensing authorities, and it is verified in a number of different ways that are acceptable by accrediting bodies, which the plans and hospitals have to adhere to. So they are a piece of this. And I did want to stress that, of course, we are not making the decision to credential practitioners. That is still on the the organizations to do that, and we do not include the process of privileging. So there are a lot of questions as to what we verify and how we verify information. We'll be putting out more information as to the very specific details of how that will happen, because what we verify initially versus every 120 days versus ongoing monitoring is of great interest to those organizations that have to adhere to accrediting body standards. So those are kind of the nuts and bolts and the concerns and the good things about credentialing in a nutshell. So any questions about that? Okay. So I just wanted to have a slide on what our vendor team looks like. This is government, so we have a number of other things going on and processes that we need to go through. So Periton in the center is our systems integrator with the Office of Health Information Technology, in which this program is under. We have two other IT infrastructure projects. One is provider directory and one is clinical quality metrics registry. Mm-hmm. We were required by the Department of Administration to put a systems integrator over the procurement and management of the implementation of bringing these projects on board, because they are essentially three large IT projects. So that's why we have this systems integrator there, and they help with the project management. They helped with the procurement, and they'll assist in the testing and management, again, of that implementation. Conduent and MedVersant are our actual vendors as a partnership for doing common credentialing for the state of Oregon. We don't do credentialing in the state. We never have, so we are going out to procure. So we've actually selected them, and they're on board, and we are working with them. Conduent is basically the lead partner in that relationship, and they will be providing the help desk services and overseeing MedVersant and project management and the like. So MedVersant is actually the system and the credentials verification organization. They are certified as that through NCQA and the accrediting body. So they are actually going to be doing the collection and verification of the information. One Health Part is an added thing based on the fact that most providers and provider organizations use One Health Part as a single sign-on, so a single username and password to get into multiple plans to do eligibility verifications, claims, transactions, benefits, lookups, and that type of thing. So most practitioners and practice organizations are very familiar with that and already have credentials through there. So we were encouraged by the Oregon Health Leadership Council and OHA leadership to really, and our advisory group to really use One Health Port. So they are a part of this, and that'll be the door for the practitioners to come into the system.
I have a question about Conduent. So is that
sure.
Is responsible for all MedVersant deliverables? Is that just up until the implementation, or are they overseeing anything after go-live?
Ongoing. So Periton is the variable in that, whether or not they have a piece of this ongoing is separate and apart, but Conduent and MedVersant are the credentialing vendors. That's a fun slide to talk through. Who are all these people and companies? It's complicated. Okay, so what we're doing right now, again, the vendors are all on board, so we have been in the nitty-gritty of working through system configuration. We also have a number of other things going on. We're basically building an entire business from the ground up. So we have to have our procurement of our IT system. We have to have all our operational policies. There's a fiscal service component of this. Many of you know it's going to cost money, and it's going to be on the backs of the credentialing organizations and the practitioners. So there are fees associated with this. So we have a fiscal services. We have marketing and outreach and those types of activities. So we have really been working hard on moving those pieces into finalization. We've worked with stakeholders along the way on pretty much everything involved in this process, procurement, the fee structure, the operational and credentialing policies and the like. So we also have rules that we need to put forward. So we have our statutory requirements, and then we have to do the more detailed rules. So we have been going through that process in the last 5 months or so with another group, the Rules Advisory Committee, but it's basically our subject matter expert group that has been acting in that capacity. And they're basically a lot of credentialing managers in there, but Mark Bonanno has participated, and we also had the medical board, a representative from there participating, and I think another few extra legacy. So we just added on some folks to make sure we had a wide breadth of input into those rules. So we intend to finalize those by January 1st. We already had program rules from 2014, so we were just adding in the program details. That was preliminary, basically, what we had finalized last time. So that one does include fees and a little more detail on as to how credentialing organizations participate. Other things that we're doing, again, operational policies, credentialing policies. We're trying to work with national accrediting entities to ensure their buy-in, that we have credentialing policies that meet their standards or do not interfere with their standards in any way. Marketing and outreach, we have a new program logo, which we did not put on here. We haven't really fully publicized it, but you'll see that soon. And outreach materials that will be pretty much based on feedback we've seen in the past. Of course, we're going to have all the program information, but feedback we've had as to what are the questions, how am I going to get in here, what is it going to provide me exactly. So, again, the verification of stuff. How that's going to happen, screenshots, and all those fun things. Mm-hmm. So working on that, we're also going to be working on return on investment surveys with the Medical Association and also with the Oregon Health Leadership Council to ensure that we have a good collection of what the credentialing process is costing and how it works within organizations now as a kind of a baseline information for us to measure against a year after the program is up and running. So doing that, and then we also will be engaging another group of stakeholders, and those are technical advisors. So the reason for that is we would need some technical assistance and advice from our stakeholder organizations that will be actual users in testing, and also for organizations that want to consume data. And I look at Valerie because her organization wants to consume data from our mm-hmm. system. So again, those organizations that already have their system and they may use them in other ways, they will not eliminate their own systems. And it would work more effectively if they were just to get the data from our system and put it in their system for working with it. So that's part of what that technical advisory group will be doing. So as you can see, there's a lot of stuff happening right now. So then moving forward, we will, on the next slide, we will just be finalizing a lot of that, activating an adoption plan. Our date for the program to go live mm-hmm. is late 2018. We had put September 4th, 2018 in there. And we had some feedback. So we put that in the latest draft of the rules. And we had some feedback as to how it was actually going to roll out and wanting more of a pilot period. So we're exploring our options as to do we need to extend an early adoption period, because we had 2 months put in there. So after testing, we would have organizations and practitioners come in as early adopters to, if there were any quirks, we want to make sure that we work them out. And that's essentially our pilot period. So we had some feedback on that. So that September 4th date may change a little bit. And then I just also wanted to point out that there are still opportunities for engagement for those of you that might not be heavily engaged at this moment. I know a few of you are, for sure, but we have our Common Credentialing Advisory Group. That's a public meeting. Anybody's welcome to attend. Call in on the phone. Listen to the webinar, the webcast of it, and then it is recorded, so you can come back later and listen to the conversations and get the materials. Our subject matter expert work group, that is, again, 30 members strong, so a lot of folks participating on that from a detailed level. We usually iron out and brainstorm different options and issues and then bring those up essentially to the advisory group. That is not a public meeting. You would have to request to be a part of that. But we also engage folks via different forums. So I have professional associations there. You can also communicate with professional associations such as the U of May. Mark is familiar with that. They are definitely a sounding board for us, and they definitely provide us information if they're hearing things or needs or concerns in the community. Hospital Association as well. So that's pretty much where our stakeholder engagement lies, is in the two main groups, but hopefully revamping our website very soon to put a lot more useful information on there and kind of an implementation status. So that's a lot. I will stop there. And any comments, questions?
I have a question. I think a couple years ago I may have gone to one of the initial meetings. And so, you know, we have 80,000 nurses,
mm-hmm.
but not all 80,000 nurses are going to be a part of this. And there was at times some type of a list.
Right. That's in the rule.
And that's in the rule. And then the mandatoriness of that, I guess, is sort of a big, giant question for me.
It is mandatory for all advanced practice nurses.
Okay.
So
but,
registered for
okay.
CSIS.
Okay. All right.
But not RNs.
But not RNs.
Yes, right.
So that's going to require a rule change for me, and I write those rules for the Board of Nursing. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
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 That's it. But I'm in the rules right now, so that I might be able to get with you offline.
Yeah, get with me offline. I'm not sure how much you would have to put in there if they're coming to our program.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that you're sending them here. So I don't know. So, yeah, we can
talk
offline.
Okay.
Thank
Perfect.
You.
Thank you for that.
Anybody on the phone? Okay. Okay, so we wanted to just touch on this really quick. Being that the OPCA is the basis for the information in the system, we and also that we will still be using a paper application for extreme circumstances, we're essentially allowing practitioners a waiver to not have to enter into the system electronically but use a paper application. Their information will still be input into the system by someone on our side and verified and managed in that sense, but in the event that there's an extreme technical or circumstance or a disability, we anticipate really looking at that with some strict standards and not granting many of those waivers at all, but we will still have a paper process at this point. However, what we will be doing is that 120-day attestation. So essentially the recredentialing application will not be utilized by practitioners. And so we will just be maintaining those updates in the system. So we will be eliminating the OPRA. And it's not a requirement that we have an OPRA in statute, so we will just be taking that off the table. So I wanted to make sure that you guys were aware of that.
Yep.
All right.
Melissa, this is Danielle.
Yes.
So when this system is up and running and even from the beginning when we're recredentialing people, so the information in the system will pre-populate the OPCA so that when we're credentialing or recredentialing, we're going to get a full initial application every time. So
correct.
At reappointment where we don't need their education or information for the past 10 years, we're still going to get that format?
Correct.
Because we're getting rid of the Oprah?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I will turn it over to Luke.
Can I ask a question before you move on?
Yeah, sure.
So I'm touching on what you were just bringing up. The information that isn't going to be changing, is that possible to sort of have it in sort of a like a back file so that you don't have to review and edit that each and every time because it doesn't change? Is it necessary for everyone to touch it and look at it and page through it each and every time?
Well, unfortunately, that's how the system works. So what they do is the practitioner attests, and all of their application information is in there. But when all the primary source verification is done, they basically put it into one PDF file. And so that's how it's kind of viewed. So the application is always in there, and that so it's always a full record that they're producing. So unfortunately, yes, it's in there, and you would page through it.
That's one of the advantages of the RA system is that the OPRA is that it's condensed and it's much quicker to go through. So it would be wonderful if there was some way to just lock down the information that isn't going to be changing, doesn't have to be reviewed each and every time, if you could pass over it more quickly. Some of the other online systems are very tedious, and when they do updates, they'll spit out an edit or an error message that you have to continually go back to, and it's data that doesn't change. But for some reason, they change their formatting, and then you have to go back into it and review it again and again and again.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think what they're doing here is it's a PDF, so you pull it down. So you can view it in your system. I have to see if there's any kind of restrictions as to how you view it or if you can just go into certain pieces of it. But I know that they just have, like, the PDF there, and you just print that out and take it to your system or whatever you
and
want to do
the,
with it.
And from the practitioner side of it, it
yeah,
works in different. In well, it works in much of the same way, so there isn't a way to review that sort of abridged version, but you're basically, we're asking you to update it whenever a change is made and to attest to all of that information every 120 days.
Right, and I'm sorry, yeah, so your practitioner perspective. So the way the MedVerson system is set up is they have the different tabs on the side. So you don't have to go through each tab in order to finalize. And when you go to click to attest, unless there's something missing in those sections, which there wouldn't be because you would have previously filled them out, then you would just click
over it.
Right. And if you didn't have anything to change, you don't need to go into any of those unless there's something that has expired.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
Exactly. It's very much like CAQH, which I think I talked to you about years ago.
Right.
When the OPCA populates, like with education, does it put the value that the provider put in there, or is it what was verified? Like
what
if it's been primary source verified, so say the provider said they graduated in June and really it was in August, which of those is going to populate in the OPCA?
Right. I don't know exactly. So I don't know how they go back and change if any of those fields are changed.
So
I don't really think so.
As a health plan or a hospital, you'll have access to basically two versions of each healthcare practitioner's application. So you get that data, all the information they've entered, once they attest, so that's kind of like raw data. MedVerson hasn't gone through and done their checking to make sure that, checking is that it's complete and verification. So then the second version is fully verified file. So in instances where, and that's a good question about it just being completely wrong month, but it's understandable. There are instances where you just may enter a number wrong, and when MedVerson goes in to verify it, whether it's
The licensing. License number.
License number, and they are verifying with a primary source. They'll just make that small change mm-hmm. because they can prove, okay, well, that's clearly what you meant. You've proven that you're this person. So those changes, what happened between the raw data and the fully verified file.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I will check on that to see if they would go back and ask mm-hmm. the practitioner to change it. I don't know that they would really change
the date. Some notification that they are changing it, because the practitioner should have the opportunity to
right.
to update it or have input
right.
if they think it's not correct.
Right.
I mean,
right.
that doesn't seem quite right.
So I'll ask to make sure and follow up with you guys. So you know, it's a good question. And then I'm also wondering for organizations that want to consume the data, how exactly will they get that translated in their systems? So is it just the attachment that you guys get to look at that says, oh, it's August, or
mm-hmm.
you do get that that information updated in a data field? Okay.
And at the very least, for information that is just we can't possibly prove that that's what the practitioner meant, they'll conduct that outreach to say, oh, you entered this wrong.
If it's like an actual discrepancy.
Yeah.
Can I ask another question? This is Sarah. So say we don't do it. The practitioner of the 120 days. Let's say I'm in Afghanistan
mm-hmm.
or I had a baby. What's the that's in the rules?
Right. So we don't have any monetary penalties
okay.
attached to that. If you're up for recredentialing or credentialing, your information will be out of date and unusable. And
okay.
So that's pretty much it.
You're sort of in a hole.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
You'll probably get notices from your insurance carriers.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
yeah.
Yes.
Just want to know.
Yeah, because it'll say a non-attested yeah. practitioner. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
Luke will be doing the ACPCS.
Okay. So the next part of our agenda is the 2017 ACPCI process. Going to be this is the process where we review the Oregon practitioner credentialing application. It's going to be a little different than it has been other years, and so because we have some new committee members, Lucas will provide an overview of the ACPCI purpose and process, and then talk about how our process will be handled this year.
Thanks. Just to have a quick overview slide for our new members. This committee, as Valerie said, develops and has developed the OPCA and OPRA. It's this guiding statute requires that the committee meet at least once every calendar year to review and then provide recommendations to the OHA director on whether everything gathered in the application meets accrediting entity standards. The committee consists of 9 members, 3 payer representatives, 3 hospital representatives, and 3 practitioners or practitioner organizations. Basically, the process as it has happened in previous years, OHA staff has gone through a public solicitation for changes to the current versions of the forms. That's usually open for, I think, a month. And so then gathered all of those recommendations, then brought them to the ACPCI meeting for the members to weigh in on, approve, deny, et cetera. That process is slightly different this year, and that is, exclusively or primarily because of the implementation of the Common Credentialing Program being less than a year away. So as Melissa mentioned, the current version, what we call the 2017 version, a few changes were approved last year, so we have a new version this year. That's the basis for the information that's currently that will be collected in the Common Credentialing Solution. That system configuration is well underway, so a lot of that work of building the interface and all the data fields is already moving forward. The thinking was that to do sort of a public solicitation related specifically to the paper versions of these forms, which, as Melissa said, are more or less going to be obsolete once this is fully up and running, maybe confusing to the credentialing organizations, credentialing managers, practitioners, practice managers on both sides there, given that we won't be using the paper applications that much anymore. It was also kind of a timing thing because we really haven't, we're just about to start our big marketing and outreach push. So, you know, this is potentially a little bit confusing to anybody who, you know, hasn't been following the program to date. So we are still meeting our statute, the guiding statute, which doesn't actually say anything about performing a public solicitation. It's basically, we have to meet every year, review the applications, and make sure that they meet all the credentialing standards. And so this meeting, we want to make sure we really only have a handful. I think there's only two two recommendations for possible changes or clarifications that we've gathered this year since the form was updated last year. So we'll go through those. We're going to open it up for members if they have anything specific that they've seen in the, you know, last few years using the form where there may be a gap in meeting any standards around credentialing. If there is something that the group approves that a change is absolutely necessary, it's not impossible that that change won't be implemented in the system the day it goes live. It will be a heavy lift. Given that the system is already more than halfway into the actual configuration. But that's what we want to get member input on, because if there is something, you know, we'll have to update it. That being said, this slide is just an overview flowchart of the normal process as I sort of described it. If there are any recommended changes coming out of this meeting, OHA would take them back. We would seek the advice of our Common Credentialing Advisory Group, gather that input, and then finalize any change recommendations and get them to the OHA director for approval. Then on the right side, you'll see, I think that's the process of if any administrative rules are needed to implement the recommended changes, that would be the path of going about that. I'm not sure that that's... Mm-hmm.
We haven't used that in a few years. So.
That's likely. So once the director approves it, we just go through the process of working with our OHA publications department just to get the form in a good PDF, fillable, accessible, pretty format, and then we would post it. As Melissa said, at this point, it would really be if changes were made, we'd be updating the OPCA and not the OPRA.
Mm-hmm.
So anything else about the process this year?
Nope.
Yeah, Melissa.
Any questions from anyone? So then next order of business will be to review and provide recommendations for changing or not changing the Oregon Practitioner Credentialing Application Form. And the forms, the OPCA and the OPRA, were included in our packets. And then we did receive a few suggestions. OHA staff received a few suggestions that we can review, and Luke is going to walk us through those.
Yep, so actually only two ones to consider, and it's not for lack of looking. Melissa and I have been really dealing with the form on a daily basis as the system integration is gone through, because basically just scanning it in, and so it's not going to look the same. It'll be much more streamlined as a computer system should be. So we haven't come across anything crazy that would warrant, you know, any alarm. There were a couple of things, so this is going to be suggestion number one. I think that was a separate handout that may have more details, but this is related to page 12 of the OPCA, the authorization and release of information form. It has a number of clauses, and then you sign at the bottom. And so, what is this number? Item 7 for hospital or medical staff membership, clinical privileges. I acknowledge that I've been informed of and hereby agree to and abide by the medical staff bylaws, rules, regulations, and policies. So we had a stakeholder concern that they were confused when applying for to be credentialed by a health plan. By that item, they asked that health plan to provide them with their medical staff bylaws, and they didn't get a response from the health plan, so they were confused and raised it to OHA, since we manage the forms. I think what
Secretary of State and the legislature, so
yeah,
so it sparks the process. And
yeah, if you want to add anything, shoot Melissa.
Essentially, this is, yeah, so essentially this is just a misunderstanding, I feel, and an education opportunity. But the plan in question basically said that we don't have anything to provide you. You should ask the state. And they had no idea what was going on, because to them, they're reading this and they're not looking at it. The first part of that sentence says, for hospital or medical staff membership or clinical privileges. And so it basically wasn't very clear to them that that was separate and apart from their role. And so they were just looking at it like, I haven't been informed of these things. Do you have these things? Can you provide them to me? And instead of the health plan saying, like, okay, you don't need these things, this is for a hospital, so it could have been easily mitigated via education to the practitioner by that health plan or whatever. Mm-hmm. So the question is because we were asked to see if we needed to change the form, we were asking this in a public forum to make sure that, do we really think this is clear? Is there a better way to put this in the application, or is it just an education issue?
If you're not credentialing people and you're not privileging people, and that's still up to the hospital and their bylaws, why is it there?
I agree.
Right. So the reason why we created this attestation sheet and those pieces is they were required for different organizations to have different sign-offs on different things for not only accrediting entity standards, but more than that. It was more than what do we commonly need as organizations for these practitioners to sign off on. And everybody basically said that this is one of the statements that we need them to sign off on. And so that's really how it ended up in here.
Sure.
So hospitals are required to give a copy of the bylaws before they're approved for credentialing?
Yes.
Okay.
And I just credentialed them. I got mine.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm just, I never noticed it, actually, that particular part. Yeah. I just signed it. I'm one of those people that put it in front of me in the wet signature, I guess I would say.
right.
But I understand it, but I do take pause with, it's to be helpful to agencies, but it isn't really the role, so that is a little confusing.
Right. And I think from accrediting entity standards, and you, Valerie, and Danielle would be more helpful here, and Eric as well, talk to hospital representatives, but You know, they are, you are going to get a sign-off on the bylaws. So you have to sign the bylaws separately as a practitioner, correct? Or is this your actual sign-off?
I had to do both.
Okay.
And at Providence, we would look at our sign-off again and see if we have it in two places if we could. Because it's always been in the release.
Mm-hmm.
From the very beginning, it was one of the requirements for the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, so this is Danielle.
Uh-huh.
I actually have a separate form that they sign that says that they have received a copy of our bylaws and rules and regs, and I make sure that I have that form because it actually goes with the copy of the bylaws and rules and regs.
Okay.
This is Kane, and we privilege our providers, and we have a separate attestation as well for them to sign if they are privileged.
Do you not have a separate one, Mallory?
We have a statement that they sign. I'll review it and make sure it includes all this information.
Right.
And so it is possible. There are other avenues, as you say.
Right.
Just asking the question, mm-hmm. not to say to take it out.
Yeah,
exactly.
The devil's advocate.
Mm-hmm. My concern is if there are hospitals that don't have
yeah, how would we, yeah, it's hard to
Or not randomly, but
we change
all of a sudden taken out.
Mm-hmm. How many people, how many hospitals would be impacted by that, by having to have a separate process.
Especially with education around it, though. I'll tell you,
right.
Not a lot of, there's a lot of people that are in independent practice and not necessarily working for a hospital. So when they're now required to fill the form out, there will be pause. But if we have an explanation, I think it's easy and you have the clause.
Right.
For hospital.
I think it's slightly intuitive. Unfortunately, I do. I think this is kind of like a CYA,
yeah.
And making sure that you have an extra signature saying, yes, you've seen these and you're aware of these.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a great thing. Say CYA in a public meeting? No. But
it's
creative. Right. So, you know, essentially, I think it is just, you know, every once in a while you're going to get somebody that's going to get, wait a minute, what? What am I supposed to be doing? I'm confused about this. And you know, did that person spend enough time reading it thoroughly or, you know what I mean? And then, again, it could have been kind of mitigated on the health plan side by saying, hey, this doesn't really apply to you. But, again, this is meant to be a catch-all form, not just health plans, but also hospitals, and the system is the same. So I don't necessarily see a need to do anything, but it's up to this group to make the recommendation as to keep it, suggest a change, or suggest that we just notify organizations, you know, to the extent that we can to ensure that they are aware of this type of situation.
Could any additional information be provided in the glossary like you have other things? Could you provide some additional explanation?
Include a definition of hospital and medical staff? There are definitions.
Yeah, because it's mainly definitions,
mm-hmm.
right?
And there's the glossary.
So, I don't know that there's.
Could you put in FAQs or something?
For it.
Or maybe an asterisk?
Right.
Some clarification.
Because
I've filtered out many times. So I'm just wondering, I'm just being honest. I like that it's assisting the stakeholders. That makes sense to me. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it should still be in there. It has purpose to be in there. If it needs to be clarified or an additional statement at the end saying this, this element is waived for, you know, if you're only applying at a health plan or something, if it really needs any of that. I think it sounds more like the health plan should have read it a little closer, in my personal opinion.
And as Melissa has been saying, we've been using this application since 2000. Has this come up as an issue?
Right.
Never had any requests
for me.
So anybody want to make a motion?
So
I'll make a motion to leave it as is.
Thank you. Do we call for other discussion?
Call
for a second.
I'll second.
Okay.
Any other discussion? Anyone on the phone have any other things?
No.
This is Danielle. I go with the current motion.
Thank you. So those in favor? please indicate.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Thank you. Those opposed, please indicate so. Okay. Are there any members who are abstaining from voting? No.
Okay. There are a lot of nuanced pieces of this meeting. That's what we do at this group. But we do have to address things that come up. So I appreciate walking through that.
Thank you. Good discussion. And we have another suggestion.
Yeah, so I'm actually thinking about this one and realizing it is specific to the recredentialing application. So I'm raising it because it was specifically put forward by one of our Common Credentialing Advisory Group members, and since it's a committee that looks at both forms, I told her that we would raise it. So it's basically just a wording clarification on the recredentialing application, the attestation questions, and this is a question about whether you've had any liability claims or lawsuits closed or filed against you. So basically on the OPCA, it asked the question, have you ever had any claims filed or closed? On the OPRA, as you can see on the slide, it asks in the last 5 years, and I think the suggestion here was that it's a little confusing to have the word ever in the OPRA version, because it's really in the last 5 years. Have any of these been closed or filed against you? So just kind of a wording thing. And again, that the consideration for deciding whether to change it or not, you know, we're not using the OPR.
There's a version of it in this, though.
There is.
This is Danielle. I had a question. Mm-hmm. So I understand that they're going to have to reattest every 120 days. So are they, when you get to re-credential, you get to go back just a couple of years, so providers don't have to keep reattesting to that malpractice claim 20 years ago. So is the attestation going to change from the first attestation to next, or are they always going to have to attest and always explain yes and always, obviously the information should be in there, but are they going to always have that pop up in their face?
So, no. Yes, the information will always be in there, but it's not a, you don't have to prove, you know, scroll through, as Melissa said, every single piece of information that you've already entered and then clicking a test button each time. You're clicking one button, giving an electronic signature, saying you attest to everything in there. So unless anything has changed related to that claim since the last time you've entered it and attested to that information, it's not going to come up in your face and say, is this still here?
Right, but then the paper copy of the attestation for the credentialing organizations is going to be essentially every time, it's going to be a forever history. So every time we get that attestation, it's always going to have every single yes answer from beginning of time, so we'll have to go through and say, oh, that's one that was dealt with already, or, oh, nope, that must be a new one.
Right, yes, it will.
Yeah. This is Sarah. I will say, too, at the Board of Nursing, we have a very similar question on the applications for licensees, and we got in kind of a squirrely situation with the ever and open and disclosure, because these cases can take years.
Right.
And we license every 2 years, and then finally when it was settled, we were given the information about a malpractice situation, but the applicant on the renewal said there was nothing going on. So that's just one thing I bring up about being very careful about what you're trying to get after and for new cases that are open.
Right.
So I don't have an exact science to give you, but I just think these words really do matter and can be slippery.
So the actual OPCA, it's on page 11, and number N, or letter N, something, have any professional liability claims or lawsuits ever been closed or filed against you? So filed against you captures those non-closed or settled ones.
Which they would then have to, if it was filed against them, it's still open. Once it closed, they'd have to go back in and reattest, and that's a new explanation that they're giving, right?
Right. It'll still have
the original
open explanation in the now. Right. Change. Right. I wonder if that
calls.
Sorry. Go
ahead. The question that this request is kind of a moot point because we're not going to have a separate out of station, correct?
Right. So then we don't need to worry about the ever been on there because we don't have a timing requirement on the OPCA. It just says anything ever.
This would have been a good thing to update like 5 years ago. Because we get a lot of questions and they're like, you say 5 years and then ever.
Yeah. So, Danielle, I do want to clarify a version of these questions will be in the common credentialing system, much how they look here.
These ones will be.
Yeah.
Not the OPRA, though.
Yeah, not the OPRA.
Right. So, yeah, it is a moot point. But in thinking about that, in terms of attestations, to put my centralized system hat on, it would be worthwhile to take a look at like information bubbles that are pop-ups, like what do we want you to put here and when do we want to, and the question has always been, when they go to a test, what do they see on the screen, like, be sure to update anything that's going to expire. Be sure to provide information about claims and
whatever. Yeah, and I'll have to check because I believe we include any status changes in claims, new claims, any expirables such as DEA, board certifications, licenses, and a number of other big things just in that attestation page as a reminder of things that may have changed.
Right. Those important pieces.
Good.
Okay.
So any other discussion on that suggestion? And do we need to have a motion for that?
I think it would be a motion to disregard the suggestion.
Would anyone like a
motion? Deny. We considered it, but we...
A motion to not care.
Thank you. All in favor? And any opposed? Okay, thank you. So is this the point where we ask if there are any other suggestions from the groups for recommendations of changes other than what we've received?
Well, I have one, and I almost hate to even say it, but this came up for the first time in our clinic yesterday, so it's on the top of my mind.
Mm-hmm.
This whole gender, male, female, other things.
Oh, thank you.
And at the time I thought, oh my gosh, this is going to involve so much rebuilding of forms and everything. Anything that comes from the ground level should include that.
Mm-hmm. So there's an actual statute or something that's coming out saying you need to collect. What is it? Male, female, and then what is the other term?
Non-binary, I believe.
Okay. Yeah.
I haven't seen that. I think it might be binary.
Mark, do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I don't. I can look it up though.
I can send.
Okay.
We changed our apps. I can send you.
You did language. Change your app.
The other thing that might need some clarification and where it came up in our office is somebody transitioning. And at what point they go from being checked as male to female or vice versa, and then what the patient reports was different than what the insurance company has on file, so the claims are being rejected.
So I've talked to or have heard other conversations about this, and I think it came up in the last OMS conference as well. Dorothy, you should remember, maybe.
Can I bring it up?
I don't remember. It came up in one of the forums, too, as to what do you end up doing when someone transitions. If they have a name change, you basically need to submit all your paperwork over again. But then you would have that AKA or other names used that would need to be assessed for background And so, but during transition, you're still the same person. You're still under that same name. It's really only if you have a name change. But then you need to update everything, your contracts and everything else. It's just like anything. You get married and you change your name and you got to change your bank and you got to change, you know what I mean? So I think that's...
So there's actually kind of two different things if I'm hearing. So there's the name change, which
right.
when I spoke with a patient, you know, they said that had been in place for 2 years.
And then the identity.
But then the physical part, and this person was halfway through the process.
So
it's like, at what point?
We
took the opinion that what we enter in our system is what the patient reports.
Right. So why are the claims being rejected? Because
it hits an edit in the claim system that we're reporting as a male and they have it listed as a female. So there's an edit. And a lot of health insurance has edits for
right.
a lot
it's
of procedures.
It's not on the practitioner side and contracting. It's on the actual patient side.
Right. And I did speak with a patient. And
interesting.
He said his name had been changed for 2 years legally, but that the insurance company hadn't updated it. I mean, this is kind of different, but it's like it kind of rolls into the
But
yeah,
then
the
minor, process. We definitely changed all of our applications.
Okay. Then we should probably make a motion to do something about changing this application. But in regards to your concern about the claims bombing from the practitioner, from the patient perspective, I think I'm going to bring that up to the Oregon Health Leadership Council because they have a broad membership that could touch a lot of the payers. So
I did contact the insurance carrier as well. This is
right.
totally side. I'm so sorry.
But to get a broad stroke of
they
payers.
Yeah. Basically, that the patient just needs to call in and change their information with the insurance carrier, which that is in the process of happening, supposedly. So I'm not sure that it's that big of an issue. I think it's a matter of just getting the insurance company to catch up to the patient's request. But
right, or to make sure that their claims systems don't bomb them,
right.
but they flag them for follow-up. So... Yeah.
So, Melissa, this is Mark. It was House Bill 2673 from this past session, just so you have that.
Thank you.
And the bill did not touch on in any insurance code provisions, so that's good information to have, and we can take a look at that.
Okay, yeah.
And I was going to say, we did a physician statement on caring for transgender patients at the Board of Nursing. I'm happy to send that as well.
Yeah, that would be awesome. And Mark, from your perspective, it might be, you know, an educational opportunity for practices to I don't know how they would approach this or you guys would approach this, but if you're a doc and you have a transgender patient, it's you know, how are you identifying and how do you identify it to your insurance company? I don't know if you guys want to get involved in that, but
well, we do. We provide some basic information to them, and a lot of this falls under the work we've been doing on the non-discrimination pieces of the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
We provide some basic information to them, you know, about this and what it means. The American Medical Association also has a pretty deep bench of resources as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
Gender is going to be a required field in the online application, right?
Mm-hmm.
I know they changed the DMV as well.
I really think there's a requirement to change everything.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I know that somebody flagged this for us, and I don't think anybody followed up. I certainly didn't.
Just that it is on the DMV application.
Yeah.
But I would ask our members on the credentialing organization side if that has any effect on performing verifications, because obviously name change does, and so the application addresses that by gathering any other names that you've used and the dates that you use them, because they'll have to do verifications from those timelines. I'm just curious if gender comes into play in any of the sources that are...
Not any of your verifications?
Not so much. I mean, like... Gender is on the NPI, but other than that, nothing that we really touch includes gender for verifications, but we have to do an annual non-discrimination report for our credentialing committee, and gender is one of the elements that we look at to make sure that we're not discriminating against providers or bringing on our panel. So that's why I was asking if it was a required field. But if they're required to say one or the other, then...
So going back to, that's helpful input, going back to if anybody wants to make a motion to adjust the application to not.
I move that we address the application is addressed for gender according to House Bill 2673.
Okay. Thank you, Cindy.
One second.
Thank you. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, thank you. Are there any other comments from the committee or suggestions for changes?
I wanted to ask a question really quickly. So hospital affiliations, if you have an affiliation with a hospital, you automatically have privileges?
No.
To admit?
No.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
So that's like the second piece of verification that we have to do. Because we gather affiliation, but then CMS won't specifically look at if you can admit or not.
And that brings up a very interesting point, because the practice that I'm in with allergy and dermatology, in the 8 years I've been at this clinic, they've never admitted a patient. And so they don't want to have to meet all the qualifications of being admitting, and usually we can get an exception kind of to the rule. But a lot of the applications don't really allow for us. There is usually a yes or no or that kind of thing, and oftentimes there's different qualifications, and I think Providence is one that's come up with this, where you have courtesy or affiliate or... there's different
yeah, membership status,
right,
as well
right.
as the privileges. You can request privileges with admitting privileges or without.
Correct.
And then you could have your other clinical privileges for consultation purposes.
Correct.
Yes.
Thank you. That was very clear.
Yeah, I've never seen a health plan, you're right, I have to answer that question. Who does my call coverage, even if I don't have admitted privileges?
Some of them, and I believe it's CAQH that allows us to upload an admitting plan.
Mm-hmm.
And especially we do that with our mid-level providers, our NPs and PAs, that we can do that because they don't hold admitting privileges, that they defer to the physicians, but then the physicians defer to sell their exception. So it's a little bit, it's not always very clear on a format like this because it's kind of unusual.
Right. And so this format doesn't ask for individual admitting privileges. And the affiliation, and the system is set up like that too. So if that's a problem, then we should think about having a separate question under each affiliation for admitting privileges. Do you remember this coming up at all in the past, Valerie?
I don't really remember, but it's the practitioner, the person filling out the application may know whether they have admitting or not admitting, but it still should be verified with the organization.
Right, so they would need to know by organization, not just in general.
Yeah. Yes.
We'll say this came up in the demo, and we viewed that page with the stakeholders.
Oh, it did too? Okay.
I'm actually going to the demo environment to double check how they... So nothing came up from those stakeholders.
Okay. Because they, specifically have this question, do you...
So the question is phrased... Sorry to interrupt. Phrased, do or did you... Do you currently or have you ever had hospital privileges as a leading yes-no question? So it's not asking specifically about admitting, or I guess that is technically...
Well, what's happening is if you select yes, it doesn't ask you if you have admitting privileges. It only asks you if you do not have admitting privileges if you select no.
It does ask. Ask for... the state, a privileging status where there are numerous types. So it's admitting, co-admissions, consulting admissions, non-admitting, pending provisional. There's
okay, so that would capture
eight
then.
Or nine
so,
others.
Okay.
And that we did go through that as
but then we had changed their question. So if you do not have admitting privileges, explain your continuity
yeah,
of care.
The,
so we matched
it
on. Okay.
And
so
it gives you, yeah, you have to give you a little text box to explain your continuity of care plan for admitting in that instance.
That's helpful.
Are those
information.
Terms consistent across all hospital systems? Because there's courtesy, affiliate, and there's...
Really.
Well, those options, this is Danielle, the options that Luke just said was more having to do with privileges, not with their membership. And those two things are completely separate.
Good point.
So active and courtesy, those have nothing to do with whether someone does, or, depending on the facility, does or does not have privileges. Someone can have admitting privileges and be active and admitting privileges and be courtesy.
Or be active.
Oh,
so,
fun. So it's like we need two separate.
Membership and privileges. Separate. Those need to stay separate. But I guess the thing is in ensuring that when people say, I don't have admitting privileges, and then they say, here's my plan, if what they put down is not acceptable, we're able to go to the provider directly and ask for an admit plan that is appropriate,
right.
Correct?
Right.
Okay.
And you would probably...
Some will say, I just refer them to the ED, and a lot of health plans, that's not an acceptable admitting plan. So if they answer it incorrectly, we can ask them to either update the system or provide us with an update.
Right. Yeah, I would recommend to them to update the system so that not everybody asks them for that.
Right. What I've run across a couple times, too, is when a health plan has an inclusive requirement that you are on one of their hospital plans, that your admit plan has to say you will admit to their hospital or have affiliations to admit to that particular
hospital.
Okay,
it might need to be separate.
Correct.
Okay.
So it can't necessarily be a blanket thing to meet everyone's special needs.
That's a good point.
And, Melissa, the way you're explaining it, or Luke, you were asking that question of, for each affiliation, do you have privileges? And if they say yes, and it's not a category that is having admitting, then it's like, okay, well, what's your admit plan for patients at this facility? So that they would have to answer that question for each affiliation, or is it the admit plan more of a one, like she was saying, if they say, if they only put it in one,
that's
it could be very specific to only work for one place.
In the system, that's a blanket question, so that might be a problem.
That sounds like a problem.
Yeah, because they would have different levels of membership and or privileges at each affiliation, and then most places would want to know what the admit plan is for each affiliation, potentially, depending on the health plans they're with.
So how come this couldn't have been a problem brought up on this application? Do you guys feel like it's been a problem for you in the past?
I feel like
because
no one verifies it. Am I wrong?
Well, we verify it, but we verify
that.
It.
Sorry, Danielle.
I've never
I mean, we verify it, but we have for THA, they actually have a form that we give. So
okay.
They don't necessarily do it with the OPCA, so we know that they don't do it. So we give them an additional document that is very, very clear. That piece of paper is just asking about admit. We say, you know, you can't say that you're sending them to the ED. We give them more information than what the OPCA does. So it's probably a combination of people don't check, and then if they are, they're using another form.
Right.
So most of what we do is if it's a hospital, a lot of the hospitals that we contract with, we can verify the privileges on the app or directly on like the legacy website or whatever. So we kind of ignore, we take the name of the hospital where they say they have the affiliation at as a reference, and then we go out and we verify it ourselves. And it doesn't always match here. Or they'll not check this box, but they can't admit, or the opposite. So would it be possible, like you said, to have under each affiliation indicator that they can admit?
I'm
going to just be honest.
Yeah.
I've filled this out many times.
Uh-huh.
There's been points in my career when I've had admitting privileges. There's been points when I haven't.
Uh-huh.
The last time I filled it out, I did not go into that whole history. Because I knew that they were going to take this and then they were going to input it into their system. So I didn't sweat it. But your point that this is a whole different ballgame, and it will be historical.
Right.
I think it probably is going to require that level of detail.
Like affiliate from this, because the providers I work for have been practicing for like 50 years. So
exactly.
They have like times where they were active, courtesy, affiliate.
Mm-hmm. That's why I just
time
do it.
Yeah, so it sounds like they're capturing some of that individually in the system, but it's not in that separated way, membership versus privilege. So, okay, so I guess two questions here. Danielle and Valerie and Kane would also be helpful. If we can work, and Eric, if we can work with you guys to see if there's a better way to do this in the system and pretty much ASAP, because they're configuring for any needed changes right now. So this will probably put a little riff in their day. So if we can work with you guys kind of via email as to finding an approach for it in the system, if we really need to change something. And then I guess for this group, we would have to see what would our motion be to do to this form on paper.
One thing to consider, too, is maybe the last 5 years or something, because...
This one is for... Doesn't this have a time frame or no?
It?
No, it's just all current.
It's current in time.
Okay.
Current,
like,
yeah,
yeah.
Just put some
current
parameters around it, because otherwise it's going to be...
Right.
Kind of crazy, like you said, if you've been in practice 60 years.
Well, it is current.
Well,
but then
current
the practice,
status,
right? And then you don't need to know that stuff really for
right.
the
but
work.
If they're really only after what's current, then
yeah,
perhaps
maybe.
We don't need all those other time frames.
No.
Mm-hmm. So the current affiliations be what you're practicing now. There's an area for previous affiliations, and once that's been filled out, you don't need to go back to that.
Yeah, so previous affiliations, do you need that detail for previous affiliations?
Well, it doesn't
or you
drill down to the
right.
affiliates and all those other.
Are we talking about their staff status or we're talking about the admin plan?
The status.
For prior affiliations, because I think the admin plan is only for current.
Right. Right. So
I don't know. I mean, me personally... Just like, I'm sorry, I don't know who said it, maybe Val, but providers most of the time don't even say what their staff status was at places, nor do I kind of care what they put down because I'm getting the affiliation verification, which is going to give me that information. So is it really, do we have to ask them what their status of active courtesy, I mean, what is that a regulation? Is that, why are we asking them? Because providers can go back and forth. They may not remember. They may pick the wrong category. Is it a question we even need to ask them?
Are you talking about for previous or for current?
Both. I mean...
Well, for current, we can accept attestation of affiliation. So I would say, and some hospitals, we have a really hard time being able to verify it. So we should be able to have the option to accept the attestation. So having all of those fields there for current, I say, would be important. For past, I don't really care. When we've had to verify past affiliation is due to action, and we have to go to the hospital for that.
So who actually, it's the health plan that wants this information just to cover their coverage for?
Yeah, we have to verify it. For CMS, they require that we verify the admitting privileges. And then if they don't have admitting privileges, we have to get an admit plan.
But do you guys have to verify that they were an active member of the hospital, a courtesy member, or do you it's just the admit that you care about?
Well, we do care about the status. We gather the status.
So then I guess my motion would be is just ask this information on current and not prior.
Okay, what exactly are we asking?
Current as well.
So currently on the application, we ask the status, and are we suggesting that we add admitting privileges, yes or no, to that question for current affiliations?
For each affiliation?
For each current affiliation.
Yeah.
And in my situation, we have always have that option of being opted out. So we need to, it can't be just a yes/no question. We have to have that third option available to say.
Not indicated.
Not I think how they word it when we get it back. It's like an exceptional. It's an exception.
But you either do or do not have admitting privileges. That would be a yes or no question, right?
Correct. But if you say no, then it doesn't ask for an admit plan. Oh, wait. If you say, I think
you
I said
say
that
no,
backwards.
Yeah, it should ask for the admit
yeah.
plan.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, I mean, we have...
Do you mean for your providers that don't have affiliation or that don't require it?
Say that again.
Do you mean for your providers that don't require hospital affiliation? Or
correct, because yeah. with the specialties that they have,
like
we don't have reason to admit patients.
Like a phenologist or something.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Or a midwife.
But that is specific to you. So, I mean, if they were applying to somebody else, they'd still have to give, you know, someone else may care about the admit plan. So I think it's still a yes, no, I do or do not have an admit plan at this hospital, and if I don't have an admit plan at this hospital, should one of my patients be needing to be admitted to this hospital, this would be the plan I would do for my patient.
What we do also, because there are some providers who may not need to be able to admit patients, but they still can for whatever reason, so what our policy is that if it's a pathologist or a radiologist or whoever, and they say they don't have admitting privileges, we go out and we ask, do you have patient interactions? And if not, then we're like, okay, then we don't need an admit plan. But we still need that bit of confirmation. Mm-hmm. So maybe that could be something that is put in place of an admit plan, like explaining why it's not required.
So we just have to have a field that can be free-formed then to put in that information? Or are you wanting us to just do the strict yes-no on the online form and then let the health plan follow up with additional details?
We would like to capture what we can, but if we need to do it for each individual affiliation, are they going to want to put in different admit plans
right.
for different organizations. We don't want to capture that in the system. I don't
currently
know that
the pathologists and radiologists and that kind of thing, how do they currently handle it? I've not worked in that venue.
Sorry, this is Sarah. Again, a lot of advanced practice nurses don't have admitting privileges, but some do. So, again, it's just very situational dependent. We just explain it, and then, again, on the local level, that credentialer fixes it. What that fixes on the backside, I don't know.
Right.
But when I've, you know, signed my Medicare contract and I said I was in primary care, I had to have an admit plan. But if I'm doing aesthetic medicine and I'm an APRN, I don't need to have an admit plan. So it absolutely will come up.
Right. But so then in that case, though, if you don't have admitted privileges, describe your continuity of care plan, you would say not necessary.
Not necessary.
So
online, when it asks, if it was asked at each individual level, so you have four hospitals and each question asks, do you have admitting privileges, yes or no, is the expectation that it's going to ask for an admit plan after each no answer or just at the end because you've indicated no for one of these?
Right now it only says at the end.
Okay. Well, I mean, that might be fine because, like you said, generally people don't have a different admit plan for the different hospitals that they can't admit at. So having just a yes or no field for each hospital and at the end say, you indicated no on one or more of your hospitals, please give an admit plan.
Mm-hmm.
You could say, not required, or your actual admit plan, or opted out, we don't see patients, or whatever.
We can put an informational bubble in there saying if you have separate admit plans for different affiliations, or I don't know. Okay, if I was an actual member of this group, I would make a motion to include the question, do you have admitting privileges, yes or no, and then leave it at that and have the blanket one. So does anybody want to do that officially?
Just to clarify before you vote, your suggestion is to add a yes-no field for each current affiliation entry
And remove the box at the bottom that just says if you don't have the
catch-all
check here.
There, keep, I guess, that line of text saying, please explain if you, well, I guess you just put that into the instructions at the top. If you don't have admitting privileges, please explain.
Well, we're going to keep that as a blanket question, right? So it would be, if you do not have admitting privileges, please explain. So we need a check here on this paper application, but not on the system. And I'm sorry we have to kind of transgress there. But so if you do not have any admitting privileges, please explain your plan for continuity of care. So that one as a blanket statement. So I don't think we need to really change anything here, do you?
On the form. You don't
on the form. Just in the system, we would still ask that blanket question, but you wouldn't have like a click here.
So on the form, at each current affiliation, there'll be a question admitting privileges, yes or no, and at the end, we'll just leave the statement the way it is with if you do not have hospital admitting privileges, check here and provide the explanation.
Right.
Of your continuity of care. And is that the motion that we have heard?
Nobody made the motion yet.
No one yet? Okay.
I want to clarify. Okay. This motion does include checking with each affiliation whether
right.
or not they can admit.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
I would like to make a motion that each affiliation indicate whether or not they're able to admit. On the application.
Current affiliation?
Current right. affiliation.
I will second.
Thank you.
Okay. And just to clarify, do we say, do you have admitting privileges, yes or no, or do you just say admitting privileges, yes or no? How do we want to write that specifically?
Do you have admitting privileges at this facility,
okay.
or no?
Yes or no?
And then any discussion on the motion, second? I guess we got to ask all in favor. Sorry, Valerie, you take over.
all in favor, please say aye.
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 And any opposed? Okay, thank you. Thanks for
thank you.
Discussion.
Yeah.
Question, are there any other recommendations for changing on the application? Changes on the application? Okay.
I have a technical question about online where the provider would list their supervising physician
right.
and their license number. Is that all going to be one field that they just type in, or is that going to be separated by name and license number, do you know?
It would. It should be separated by name and license number. That
oh,
should not be.
Okay.
That
not
would be bad data collection.
Not everybody has a supervising physician.
Right.
So, is that clear?
The physician assistant supervising physician.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, I think it's
yep.
clear. I was just wondering if it's going to be one or two fields
gotcha.
On the online system.
Oh, I see. So it should have it should be two fields because otherwise
right.
it needs to hit and edit that you'll get both of those elements as opposed to just
mm-hmm. so you can link
right.
the required.
Right.
Yeah.
We will make sure, but yeah, that would be bad data collection if they just had that as an open text field. So.
Are there any
and
other
questions? Luke is probably looking
yeah,
right now.
Yeah, I can't
find
it.
Awesome.
I forgot.
Clarification, when I fill these out, because I do them for 13 providers, I've always it's been unclear to me with both the Medicare number and the DMAP number. Are we looking for the individual providers or the group? Because when I think of from the insurance perspective, they want the group.
Well, from our so my company is a CCO, and we have to verify it at the provider level and the group level. So the practitioner and the organization have to be enrolled with Medicare, Medicaid for recipient claim. So when we first load the group information, that's when we gather it for the group, and when we're credentialing the practitioner,
so
that's when we
just
get it.
The individual provider.
That's what we look at, yeah.
Okay.
But there's also ways for us to verify.
I will admit that wasn't clear to me when I filled it out either.
Okay.
So
do
I can promise you I've probably convinced myself one time to do it one way. And
right.
And
do we need to make a distinction here? Like, practitioner Medicare number, DMAP Medicare number?
I call them individual as opposed to group, but I'm not sure if that's common terminology. Or
it does say over here.
For the NPI number.
Individual.
Yeah.
Or be consistent to keep saying individual.
We changed that last year because
yeah.
folks had a concern
about
it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Every
address.
Time I'm like,
yeah.
What number gets lost?
So it could make sense to continue that.
Medicare individual,
yes.
DMAP individual.
Would someone like to make a motion to add individual to the Medicare number and the DMAP number field on page 6?
I would love to make that motion.
Thank you.
This is Sarah.
Thank you, Sarah. Do we have a second? Okay.
I've given you more work.
I know. Yeah. So one thing that we have to consider with system configuration is they get a little touchy about how many fields we're mucking with and when. It's like, okay, now you're coming back. You want something else. And so we just have to address it from our end.
Could it be handled at the top?
I thought about that, too.
Your framework could just say, please provide individual ID numbers and just put
until
one.
Until you get to the physician assistant supervising.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the only place where it doesn't make sense. But how it is in the system, I don't know. So if you guys make that motion as a recommendation, then we'll take it back and see how we handle it on the system side.
I make a motion that it's handled on for the section as opposed to each individual number requirement.
Could we modify the other motion? Sorry to be stickler.
Do what you want to do. What do you want?
Just because we said we were going to do it here, but if we're, can we just modify that motion?
Yeah.
The section?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
And we hadn't made a formal motion on the other one anyway.
Okay, yeah. So then it's the same.
Okay.
I don't want to have mixed messages.
Does it look confusing when, is it confusing because then the last part there really isn't to individual? It's. It's to, well, I guess it's to their individual supervisor.
Right. It is their specific supervisor. And that's where
that's
I read that.
So it's okay?
But
okay.
It's just those other spots is where I think we all struggled when we filled it out.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, you know your DEA is your own DEA. But when you get, well, actually, so some.
Uh-oh.
Can I just clarify on the Medicare and Medicaid numbers? The Medicaid will be their individual number, but the Medicare, they'll have multiple numbers, and they'll basically be owned by whoever it's reassigned to, whether it be a hospital or an independent practice association or something like that.
But
does
did
that
you
want to
clarify
sense?
Again?
But they do have individual enrollment with Medicare as well, and we have to verify both of those.
Yes, I mean, they can have their individual enrollment, you know, if they're an independent practice, but for their actual Medicare numbers, if they, you know, with St. Charles, if they're working for us, they're going to have a reassignment number that will be unique to us, depending on our tax ID and everywhere else.
Right.
They don't have one that just goes with
right.
Medicare everywhere.
It changes by location. So
yes.
They can have
and
multiple,
they'll have multiple
they're working
numbers.
At multiple clinics. They can have multiple.
Oh, really?
So the current functionality in the system is you can have multiple entries for the Medicaid field.
Oh,
obviously,
Medicare.
Medicare. Sorry, clearly not the case on the form. So
then it might be safer to just do it here on the form in that section, saying individual, and then us taking a closer look at the system.
So wouldn't their Medicare number that was assigned if they changed locations, wouldn't that be part of like a contracting transaction between the carrier and the provider, or is that really part of this? Because this is really, everything is identifying what's happened in this provider's history.
Right.
Not necessarily, I feel like once they are issued a Medicare number that's tied to a facility, that's like tied to the contracting and affiliations as opposed to that provider's history.
It's still a unique number
yes, I agree.
To them. It just moves like you said, if I'm with Clinic A and I move to Clinic B, my number will change, but it's still my number. It still indicates that I'm currently enrolled with Medicare. I've been issued a new number.
Well, that's for Medicaid, but for Medicare, it's each a different number. They don't have one standard Medicare number that's going to follow them everywhere.
No, right. That's what I was saying. That if I moved, it's still a number to assigned to me. It's just no longer it's moved because it's site specific.
Yeah, and it's based on tax ID.
Right.
But this is Mark. Your MPI is going to stay the same.
And yes, and your Medicaid number is not the same.
It's tricky.
As is everything in healthcare.
I don't know the answer.
So does anybody want to make a motion?
Healthcare.
We can leave it as it is, and we can still take a look at the system on our side of the house. And
you're still going to do whatever you're going to do with whatever I put on here anyway, right?
Yeah. We gather the number, but the more important piece to us is we also look at if they aren't currently enrolled, because you can verify if a practitioner is enrolled with Medicare online. There's a resource for that. There's not for groups that I've found that I can access. But if they're not currently enrolled, then we also have the provider indicate whether they're pending enrollment. Because if they have no indication of enrolling with a certain line, we're not going to contract with them for that line. We're not even going to begin the process to credential them if they have no intention of enrolling. So that's also part of our verification process. I think there's value to have the field in there.
It might be blank sometimes. It might have several numbers sometimes, I guess.
Yeah.
That's just...
So in the system, it's probably okay, because if you have several numbers, they're all going to be verified. Mm-hmm. So
I've never had an inquiry about anything that I've put in those fields at all. Never received any kind of follow-up inquiry.
So is there a need to mark an individual?
What... Do we have the option of putting an informational bubble on there, like you were saying on some of the others that would say?
Yeah, we can do different stuff in the system, for sure. I mean,
it
shows that it accepts multiple.
It will accept multiple. There is a sort of glossary info bubble for...
Does it give you a pending or not applicable? Or?
Nope, just the... For Medicaid, it is just asking the number in the state, which we don't. We only ask for DMAP here, but it's basically just one extra field. So mm-hmm. if you have a different Medicaid number in different states, for Medicare, it's the same thing. It's the number in the state, and multiple entries are allowed.
Right.
For both.
Your telemedicine provider, then you could have mm-hmm. that in multiple states. Okay.
Well, some hospitals have affiliations with, like, Alaska Medicaid.
Right.
Yeah.
There you go.
I have a question about those fields, though. So if it's blank, is that a hard stop?
So most of those fields are, like, leading yes or no questions.
Okay.
So if it's do you have this? Do you have a
okay.
Medicaid number? I mean, it's are you participating... Medicare provider.
But are they required or not required?
It's mandatory to answer the yes or no question.
Oh, okay.
But
it asks for a number.
Yeah, then it populates those.
Okay, perfect. Okay.
Is DMAP still the current nomenclature? Because I thought that was outdated as well.
It is.
It's just MAP.
It is just MAP.
Very good from the non-OHA person.
okay.
Thank you.
Good.
Shame on me.
I honestly, if it said math, though.
Right. I know, right?
I'm not going to pick up. I'm going to ask you what's math.
I haven't really liked that.
I'm going to see DMAP, and I'm going to know what it is. But I'm old.
Yeah. Cool. So, maybe we just have on there Medicaid. time, if that makes more sense. I don't know why they ended up doing it. DMAP, or practitioners more familiar with DMAP?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. I struggle every time I get to these boxes. I'm like, oh, I got to go back to my secret book that has all my...
Mm-hmm. And if we change from DMAP to MAP, we'll have to change the glossary.
Yes. Any motions made?
Well,
I wanted to
yeah, so then the glossary, if people have questions, then they can go there and see if that, you know, what that really means.
So
it's
MAP? I thought
it's now,
is it the
like the Medicaid
program?
Assistance Program, Medical Assistance Programs. I think they just dropped the division.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the certainly the definition is clear, a state agency that acts as the administrator for the Medicaid component of the Oregon Health Plan, but that's really OHA.
That's what I thought it was. I'm trying to think what it said on the website.
Right.
Like when you contact them for contact information.
Right.
I thought it was OHA.
Right. It is. So, but...
But who issues the number, not OHA?
No, yeah, because it is the Medical Assistance Program. So I think I would prefer to take this one internally and see what we want to do in terms of putting that in there. You would think that just saying Medicaid number would really capture it for practitioners. I'm getting head nods from practitioners in the room. So, yeah. Okay.
Are good.
We can make that motion here if you guys want to.
Yeah, so I think we've had a lot of discussion about this section. And
a
what
lot.
Is so what is the what could our final motion be?
I move that internally they work to clarify the information that's asked for.
Ooh, that's good.
Is that too broad?
No, I actually prefer broad.
And someone want to second that?
Second.
All in favor of that motion?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? And anyone wishing to abstain from the voting? Good. Thank you. Are there any more recommendations or questions, suggestions? Okay.
Did we make any motion to say to change that section 14 to individual health care license?
No.
Sure.
I think the motion is that it be internally decided.
The whole thing. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
That's what I heard.
I thought we were just doing specific to the Medicaid.
I thought it was
glad.
Also just specific to the
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm glad
okay.
I clarified. Okay.
So let's go back then. Does someone want to clarify their motion?
Do we want to modify the last motion?
Section 14 be modified to address concerns of additional detail for clarification purposes?
Group versus individual language.
Individual language and DMAP number.
Okay.
Okay, so you're going to second again, Valerie?
Yes, I
that was your
that
original
one.
Understanding? Okay. Okay.
All in favor?
Aye.
And any opposed?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, good. Thanks for that clarification. So any other questions? Or
do we want to talk about foreign languages spoken? Because it comes up every year.
Where is it?
No. It's not in here. I shouldn't have said that. But we have never accepted it in the paper application because it's not required for credentialing and it's just too convoluted. But we do ask that question in the system. It is not a mandatory field, but it is in there. But the issue with foreign languages is always like, do you speak it? Do you speak it fluently? Does your staff speak it? Do you write it?
Yeah.
Do you read it? And so it's always like, how useful is that information? So we ask it in a generic way in the system.
Oh, I would say it has some value because we're asking at each, we're asking the question at each practice. Is so assuming somebody on your staff writes REITs, or you have
a translator,
and then it just asks in general about the practitioner themselves.
So we're in compliance with federal law to provide a translator?
You are.
That's why I was like,
Medicaid,
so why
you are. So I'm assuming that
there's a whole certified thing that you're supposed to, they're supposed to be certified.
Right.
So that's
different.
But
did
we ask it? I thought we asked it for the practitioner, though, too.
Yep.
Yeah, that's
okay. It just says language is spoken. It doesn't talk about written.
No,
yeah,
it doesn't.
Yeah, it does.
Oh, it does?
Yep.
Okay. Luke is actually
the most responsible. I see it on my end. I've never seen it say, does it, or can you, written. I only see spoken.
Oh, yeah, but for the new system.
Oh.
So can you just clarify for us, Luke? This is kind of outside of the scope of this meeting, but just...
It's a multiple choice, select all that apply type question, select all languages that you speak, all languages that you write. So that's for the practitioner in general.
They're two different questions,
yep.
Though? Oh, okay. Okay.
And they're optional, not required?
Yes.
Right.
And then, yeah, because we really can't make anything mandatory. It really has to be based on the form. There's slight exceptions where there are just those leading questions that are really quick yes or no things that, you know, we may not have asked on the form, but you can easily say no, or it'll have a non-applicable multiple choice. And then I will quickly look in the practice location.
So if these questions aren't on the OPCA, how is it, where's that going to populate when we download the file?
If you want to download the file, then you just wouldn't take those questions and populate them in your system if you don't need them.
Well, no, I mean, because you said
so
that...
Yeah, it's where, like, so they will be generated, they'll generate an actual OPCA form.
Oh, where
but you can also, we'll have to clarify that. You can, at the minimum, just get an XML of all the data fields so that you can ingest it or look at that. And I know that.
Is it an either or?
No, it's both. You can do, yeah, either or.
That's nice.
Yeah, but I don't know if, so they do populate an OPCA. So that will be populated in that way. It's not like they're adding extra questions in that visual. Because I know some of you, some organizations may just take that and scan it in. Like, they might have optical character recognition or whatever. But then those additional fields, do they have a separate kind of sheet attached to their PDF? Yeah,
we'll clarify. But
that's interesting.
You'll have access to all the data that's entered by the practitioner. So once we find out, we can just shoot out an email. But I will say for each practice entry, the questions are all languages that your staff speaks, all languages that your staff writes. Then there's a leading yes or no question. Are interpreters available at this location? If it's yes, then they ask all languages
separate.
Interpreted.
Cool. It's all separate. Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
I will stop.
Yes.
Sorry, I hate to even say this too, but on that, is it going to add the word certified interpreters? Because I always feel like I'm. It's dangerous to say you have an interpreter if they're not certified. Because of the gray area that we're in right now where we're supposed to have certified interpreters.
Take a note of that. Everything about it will be, you know, some of it maybe just dealt with how the educational piece of, you know, maybe not using this credentialing system as your source of
verification
of verifying this
certified.
But I'll look into that.
Yeah, that's another thing not required for credentialing. So, and is that a contracting thing, or do they want to know that for each practitioner?
I think it has more to do with when they print our directories. Oftentimes they'll say, we're just spoken at the
I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm. You accept new patients.
Yeah, health
plans for our
directories.
In terms of the interpreters, I think we have to report that annually to state.
That's why I wondered if that's why that was in there, so it just sort of satisfies that commitment, but I don't know.
They always had that in their system. That was
Melissa, this does raise a good question that I've spent some time thinking about, is what is the practitioner actually going to be legally attesting to? Because some of the stuff I've seen in the demonstration part, you know, has things like actual hours that they're in a clinic location. I mean, they really just can't be legally attesting to that sort of stuff. So will there be a clear delineation about what they are attesting to and what's just part of items like the provider directory and things like that?
We have to attest to the provider directory on other websites now.
Right. And so really that's a good question, because those are above and beyond the credentialing component. So maybe there's some type of disclaimer that says, I'll take that one internally to think about it, because then I'm wondering, like, does that affect the usefulness of the information? Because right now it would essentially be you're attesting for everything in your record, and that would be included in your record. But do we need to separate that out in some way in a disclaimer saying, practitioner acknowledges that these specific sections are not required for attestation? I don't know. And I don't know how that affects our process or needs.
What I would love to see is to avoid having to do, every 120 days we are required to verify all of our directory information for each of the carriers.
Right.
So if that could be tied to this format as well, since it's the health plans that already have access to this, so that we didn't have to go on to another website and do this tedious process, it would be wonderful, because that is a really, really tedious process.
Right, so we have a statewide provider directory.
I was just going to say, if we had an extra 10 minutes, we could give the provider directory overview, because that would, you know, potential centralized source.
Certainly. So just to say that in just 1 minute or less is that we do have a project going on to build a statewide provider directory, and credentialing information will populate that system. That's why we left these questions in there, because they were part of the MedVersant solution to begin with, but we kept them as optional, obviously. But that is a question, like, what are they really legally liable for when they attest to those particular questions, and the provider directory is using them. But we would want, the provider directory would have a place for practitioners to enter in their information in there, but we're still looking at, do we put more questions into the credentialing solution to have that be the single area, or because we would be using one health port to do single sign-on, they just go in and do both. Or so we're still kind of like working through, is there a way that we can centralize that for you folks? And what we did do is work with the Oregon Health Leadership Council. We didn't really do it for OHA, but just being a part of those discussions for the provider directory collection for major carriers that are with the membership with the Oregon Health Leadership Council, and they came up with a spreadsheet that practitioners now have to fill out, and that's good for multiple carriers. So that's been helpful. I don't know why you haven't seen that.
Well, I've seen spreadsheets that come out, but I have not seen a continuity between the different carriers. Each one has their own, and it's not something I can save and send out.
Are you talking about the DSM report? Is that
No. Since nothing Medicaid, it is very much regions and
United Healthcare has one that's like this long on an Excel spreadsheet. Where you
United's their own
animal. Their own
animal. Yeah. Okay. Let's follow up with you on that, too. to see which carriers are the ones that have agreed to use that collective spreadsheet.
Yeah, that would be interesting to me. I would love it.
I certainly know Regence was one of them.
Well, my experience with Regence is they're using the Avality site.
They were at the table. And they agreed. Okay.
I got an email from them this week.
Okay. An Availity site?
That's where they do their authorizations and eligibilities and benefits.
Oh, okay. All right, good to know. Okay, we will, thank you, Eric. I will take a look at that. Okay.
Okay. So now are we at the point where we've completed our
review? I'm sorry. All good discussion. You guys have been very engaging and super helpful, and we always love more puzzles to solve.
It has been very interesting. So we've completed our review of the 2018 OPCA and OPRA form, which we won't be using anymore. We reviewed the change suggestions, and I'm supposed to ask for a motion and a second to approve all the recommendations that we've discussed so far. Have a motion?
I will motion to approve the recommendations.
And a second. And those in favor, please indicate so.
Aye.
And any opposed? Or anyone wishing to abstain from voting? No. The motion to approve these recommendations as amended has carried. Those recommendations will be brought to the Common Credentialing Advisory Group for discussion, and OHA will then make a final decision on implementing the recommendations. Then this group meets again next fall.
Correct. Once a year.
Yep. Nice. Excellent. And then if anyone has recommendations, if they'd like to nominate anyone to fill our vacancies, please contact Luke. And then do we need to open it up for public comment?
So we will, and we actually dialed into the conference line a little late. So to unmute the line, if anyone from the public is on it, I'm going to ask all the members who are on to try dialing *71 now. We just signed in after the first person. It's a very convoluted process, but
just whoever
work.
Signed in as the host first.
You want to see you type that in, though, *71, because it may work for us. Just to be sure. And if not,
the first host to dial in has to dial *71.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, there's no one else in the
then there may
the
be no other members on the line, or other members of the public on the line. Anybody want to do public comment?
Okay. Well, thank you everyone for your participation today, and we are now adjourned.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.